Hello and welcome once again to In Their Shoes. My name is Vanessa Coleman, and today my guest is Charles Rees, who is a retired GP. Now, Charles, would you like to tell us a little bit about yourself, how you decided to become a GP, a little bit of a potted version of your life to date?
Well, what we're talking about at this stage, I suppose, would be the professional side of it. And actually, it's relatively simple. My mother died when I was 11. By the time I was 15, I decided I did not like the idea of death or illness, and I was going to do something about it. So at 18, I'd taken the appropriate A-levels and went to Leeds Medical School and qualified there 5 years later.
Did you qualify?
1968. Yeah. So at the age of 23, I became a doctor. I worked in hospital for 3 or 4 years in one practice for 38 years and then retired. But in the 5 years since, I have still done locums. I do appraisals on doctors. I've worked at Bournemouth Hospital. And I actually enjoy working as and when. It's sort of the icing on the cake of what was a very hard cake, I have to say.
So I'm just looking at an article in the Mail paper that says why doctors are retiring in their 50s. They hit 1.25 million pension cap, then quit. So can you tell us a bit from your perspective about this situation?
Yes, you've always got to be aware of things you read in the newspaper. It may be that, in fact, by reaching their pension cap, what they're doing is opting out of the superannuation scheme, which may not necessarily mean that they are actually leaving medicine. They may simply be carrying on working without contributing to the superannuation scheme. And I know that may sound odd to people who don't understand the NHS superannuation scheme, but it is quite reasonable for doctors after the age of 60, for instance, to take what they call 24-hour retirement and then go back to work. I did that when I was about, I think I was about 61, because there was no point in contributing further to the superannuation scheme. Now, as for are they getting out of medicine altogether, I'm not sure that they are. I know there are a lot, and that's a very good question. I do appraisals on doctors. Doctors have to be appraised every year.
Single year?
Yes. Oh, yes. It's part of the revalidation process, which occurs every 5 years. So for a revalidation, apart from any other things, you also have to have 5 annual appraisals.
So what happened in the Shipton case then?
Oh, well, it was probably as a result of the Shipton case. Harold Shipman, this appraisal and revalidation process started. In fact, it started a bit before the case was reviewed. And in fact, the review of Harold Shipman actually slowed down the appraisal process for a year or two until it got going. The idea was that appraisals would pick up malfunctioning doctors. I don't think anyone actually believes that, because bad doctors are often clever doctors. They know how to get round things, and they know how to tick all the boxes. But that's another matter. Harold Shipman was a one-off, a quite extraordinary character, who incidentally was at Leeds 2 years after me.
Oh, so you didn't know him?
I didn't know him, but people in the year below and his year will say that they barely knew him. In fact, no one seemed to know him.
Bit of an odd case anyway, just an oddball. So,
but getting back to your original question of are these doctors leaving and why are they leaving, I don't know. I go round and do appraisals. I talk to people. They are fed up. I don't know why they're fed up, because they certainly don't work the way we did. I mean, I was not unusual. I did 19 years doing nights and weekends as well as the days of the week. And I did another 15 years after that, in which one was let off from 11 o'clock at night till 7 o'clock in the morning. I mean, we just worked and worked. Nowadays, they have a 5-day week and yet they're still very unhappy about it. And
well, if you do the appraisals, why don't you know why they're unhappy then?
Well, it's very difficult to say. I'll give you an example. I did an appraisal on a doctor at Dorchester and she was very fed up about hard work. And I said,
so just tell us a little bit, how old was she?
She'd be about 35 and she was in a group practice in Dorchester.
Yeah.
And she was working, well, she was working at what we would call part-time. But I said to her, at least you get home by 6:30.
Yeah.
And she said, oh, no, I don't get home till 8 o'clock. So I said, oh, well, what time do you start? And she said, 4 o'clock. Now, it's very difficult explaining to the general public and indeed to receptionists, if you're paying £11 an hour, why somebody should be fed up just because they work from 4 o'clock in the afternoon to 8 o'clock at night. I just don't think they can hack it. And now, this may be somewhat controversial, but I have said as much to the British Medical Association. I don't know what sort of people we're producing.
What, producing for doctors or producing in a general term?
Well, I only know about doctors. A lot of them don't seem to hack it. And of course, I was in medical teaching for 30 years, and I used to always tell the young doctors, people are our raw material.
Yeah.
If you don't like them, get out and do something else.
But do you not just think that it's a state of the way people are today, not just that they're doctors, but in all walks of life? Or is it that we just see so many things on the media, you know? I don't know. I think it's people in general. Or is it that the age that we are, that we still expect people to be a certain way, and they're not today's
people?
Well,
I think that we live in a world of expectancy,
yes,
don't we?
Yeah.
I mean, Alan Sugar was criticised the other day because he said there's no poverty around nowadays. Well, he's not the only one. I've been saying there is no austerity now.
No.
There's nothing compared with the 1970s. Harold Wilson's Age of Austerity is nothing compared with post-war austerity, which I was brought up in and accepted, and nothing like the Depression in the 1930s.
Mm.
I mean, to call what we've got today poverty and austerity is a nonsense. But it isn't a nonsense if you expect a great deal more. And
yeah,
maybe that's the problem.
I think the media, the expectations, children, it starts now, doesn't it, children? My goodness, it must be very expensive to have children who want the latest, this, that and the other. I think it's just frightening. And they think it's a rite of passage, don't they, to have everything?
Yes, I think so, probably.
Yeah.
We don't want to get too grumpy, though, do we?
I don't think I've ever been. I've been called many things, but I don't think grumpy.
I don't
yet
know whether children do expect so much. They are led to expect.
Mm.
Children of all ages, throughout the ages, probably been very happy with what they've got. And like fresh air and freedom, probably,
yeah,
most of all.
Yes, yeah, so, well, of course, this is another thing, isn't it? The density of the population, the fear of letting your children out there. Things are so different from our childhood. In fact, they're quite the opposite. So if you had your time again, would you still go back to be a doctor?
Probably the answer is yes, but not as a family doctor. When I started, I wanted to be a family doctor. By that, I meant I wanted to bring people into the world. I wanted to ease their passage out of it.
Mm.
I wanted to diagnose chickenpox and measles and help people where I could. But the role of the family doctor, and maybe this is what we're getting down to with the dissatisfaction, there is not the role of the family doctor. It still exists, but it's very difficult to do now with all the constraints on doctors.
What constraints?
Well, we have a clinical governance. We everything that is untoward is recorded. Of course, this is what one looks at in appraisals. Doctors are brought up to be bullied by the health service. They're brought up to be scared of their own shadows. Don't let anyone tell you that doctors don't practice defensive medicine. They practice it all the time.
Mm.
And maybe that leads to a certain fear and dissatisfaction.
Do you think that doctors nowadays, there is this perception that doctors just look at giving you lots of medication and getting rid of you? I mean, would you say that's a fair assessment, that, you know, it's just, oh, well, bung that tablet down you and kind of go away? Am I being cynical here or what?
Well, no, you're not being cynical, you're just being wrong. No, that is not what doctors try and do. We're talking about general practitioners here.
Yeah, yeah.
No, it's certainly not. And often doctors, GPs, can see the problem. It's just that it's very difficult for them to go through the desired avenues.
Is that because of a time constraint?
General practitioners are extraordinarily efficient with their use of time. The thing that slows them down is the computerization and recording of data. And there's nothing wrong with computerization and recording of data, but there is something wrong in that it takes so much time in the consultation. That is the real problem.
Yeah.
I remember, we're going back, I don't know, 6 or 7 years now, but I remember when our computer in the practice just collapsed one morning and we had to do the surgeries without it. And I remember at 10 o'clock, one of my partners, were outside looking for patients because we'd seen everybody so quickly. We hadn't done any shortcuts. We'd simply omitted the logging of everything that we have to log.
Yeah, everything's logged, isn't it? It's logged when I go to the vets, logged when I go to the doctors, logged here, logged there, logged everywhere. Yes. So we'll leave the doctors behind for the moment. So tell us about what you do in your life now. How do you relax? What are your hobbies, etc.?
Well, you just equated relaxation with hobbies, and I don't think they are the same thing. I don't relax.
Have you got a problem? Do you need to see a doctor?
Probably. Probably. No, I think you need to work on relaxation, and it's very difficult, and especially when you do retire and you do have time for other things, you find that actually there's less time for relaxation. No, I've got granddaughters and family locally, and they take up some of the time. I'm very interested in history. I love my medieval history, Richard III Society. We've got a Dorset group.
What do you do in this society then?
Oh, we do very strange things.
Like dressing up?
You don't want to know. No. You mean in women's clothes?
No, or dressing up however you like, but no, seriously.
It's a strange thing. Whenever you mention anything historical, people say, do you dress up? And I think, what sort of world do you come from? Is that the limit of your intellectual capacity?
No, but I just have an image of all these costumes, you know, going back to jousting things and things like that. Is it? Am I way off beam here?
Yes, just about 180
degrees. Okay.
Well, let's see, what are we going to do at the next meeting? Well, we're going to do Richard III's Parliament of January 1484, in which, as people interested in that sort of thing know, that his brother's marriage to Elizabeth Woodville was deemed to be clandestine, and also he was married to another lady, Eleanor Butler.
What, at the same time?
Yes, and that's why those two little princes that people go on about, who weren't quite so little, were genuinely illegitimate. But there was another part to Richard III's Parliament, which actually was way ahead of its time. It was the first Act of Parliament that was ever written in English. Prior to that, it was all in Latin. So that anybody who could read English, and okay, there weren't all that many, but suddenly it was available to everybody who could read. One of the acts was protecting property transfer. People would sell properties that had entailments to them and that were kept secret and things like that. Mm. And that was stopped. He was very keen on law and order and justice. And he actually, one of the things in the Parliament was the starting of the bail law. So next time you're out on bail, Vanessa, you can thank Richard III.
So what years are we talking about for Richard III?
Yeah, late 15th century.
So what made you choose Richard III then out of all
of
them?
Oh, I just thought it was the Tudor tradition was absolutely outrageous. And I think trashing someone's reputation and the more is wrong anyway. And the more I found out about him, I mean, he was honest, courageous, pious, of course, all of which Shakespeare does put in his play. And of course, that wretched play is just about the most amazing trashing piece of propaganda you could ever produce. But and of course, in the end, he was very courageous. He put his crown on his head, and he fought to the death. As you know, that's what people did in those days. Let's just go into one other thing. The way we reward failure nowadays.
Oh, yeah.
Brendan Rodgers, failure.
Yeah.
£7 million. My God.
Yeah.
In those days, you went out, you fought, and if you didn't win, you just maybe battered to death. And I have to say, even Henry Tudor, he was out there at Bosworth, and he put his life on the line. And 2 years later, people think that Wars of the Roses ended in 1485. They didn't. They ended in 1487 at East Stoke near Newark. And Henry Tudor went out and put his life on the line as well. Failure was not rewarded. Success was rewarded. We live in a strange society now. So actually matching up modern life with ancient life, where things were far more crucial, I find very refreshing.
Mm. So you're also interested in today's politics as well?
A bit.
Well, I understand. Is that right? You are a UKIP supporter?
I am a UKIP supporter.
Are you a member?
Yes.
Oh, yes, you are. You are
I'm
member.
A member. Yes.
No, but I mean the listener doesn't know that. So.
Oh, I see. No.
So when did you get involved in politics with UKIP?
Probably about 3 or 4 years ago.
And what motivated that? What was the turning point for that?
Well, I'd always known that the European Union was corrupt, protectionist, undemocratic, etc.
Did it affect your working life as a doctor, or to your knowledge? Did it?
Not to my knowledge, except when they renamed most of our major drugs. So anyone who is now on Bendroflu-Methiazide would have been on Bendrofluazide. Why did they change that? And for
do you not know why they changed it?
I don't know. They change everything, don't they?
It gives a job, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Well, funny enough, I saw last night about the death of Heath Ledger, is it? And all the prescription drugs that he was taking under the names. I didn't realise that one really was Valium. So keep changing the names, I think, is a very bad idea, full stop.
Well, they have this one size fits all for everything, don't they? But
yeah.
Anyway, that's how I got interested. And, you know, the rise of UKIP was something...
Were you a party member of any other...
No.
Were you interested in politics before?
I've always had opinions, and there are things that a party will do that I would support, and the thing that another party would do that I would support. Mm. So I've really always been, like so many people in this country, I think, basically floating voters.
Yeah.
Of course, the Conservatives and the Labour people, they hate floating voters. When you sometimes they actually come out and talk about us as though we're the lowest of the low. Mm. We're not. We're just looking for a party that we can support.
Mm.
And a party that believes in parliamentary democracy for the United Kingdom is what I believe in.
Yeah. Well, in fact, I did see something in the paper. It was in the Independent. And the heading of that was, "The EU is used to bypass national democracy, Tory minister admits." The government used the European Union to bypass national democracy and pass laws that national parliaments would not accept, a Home Office minister has admitted. Well, we in UKIP certainly know that. So was there a tipping point that, you know, made you become a member of UKIP and take a part in it?
I don't think there was a tipping point. There is a crucial thing which I don't think is negotiable, and that is that we believe in parliamentary democracy. Your laws should be made by people that you can either vote in or vote out.
Yes.
At the moment, our laws, and of course this ridiculous decisions on immigration are being made by unelected people in Brussels.
Well, it's the hot potato that keeps being passed from one to another, and it's...
Well, it's a shame that immigration has been such a powerful point, because it's impossible to detach mass migration from the humanitarian aspects. Yeah. Nobody would want to do that. But it needs to be faced, and the European Union can't do it. You know, they say the horse is a camel designed by a committee. Well, the European Union is a camel.
Yes, definitely. Definitely. And the cost of it. You see, what surprises me continually, the people that I meet in day-to-day life, wherever it is, or the people I speak to, particularly in the media... it's funny because whenever I'm asked by a journalist for an interview, I, without doubt, always turn it around and ask them about their thoughts on the EU and did they know how much we pay into the EU every day. I don't think I've come across anybody who understands what's going on. And that, I think, is the frightening thing, that we're coming up, as I said, we're coming up to a referendum where people don't realise they're going to be armed with the most powerful cross that they've ever had, and that is the one that they will put in the box to either say that we stay or we leave the European Union. And I would urge anybody that to, before you put that cross, flipping well make sure that you know what the end result will be on this, because the propaganda is really frightening, isn't it, on the inside. They're going to say anything to make us stay in.
The outers, though, are coming out of the woodwork at the moment. People in industry, people in economics, a lot of people in politics, ordinary people in the street are coming out now and saying, we don't really want to be in the European Union. You know, a lot of people I talk to think it's actually going to implode long before we say we're going to get out.
Yes.
I don't know whether that's true, but, you know, people thought that about the Soviet Union, and it eventually did, and communism is become a joke. Of course, some people would say that a lot of those people from the Soviet bloc went and joined the European Union.
Well, it's the same. I mean, you know, it doesn't suit our country, does it? But the trouble is, the young people have known nothing different, and so there's always more fear for change, isn't there? Leaving.
Is. Yeah, I agree.
But in actual fact, when you think about it, let's look at the opposite. What people don't realise is that if this country does vote yes, then wait and see what they do when Brussels realise they've got us firmly in the pen. Then people I speak to don't believe that we'll be taking on the euro. But, of course, sooner or later, they're bound to want us to be in the euro. And if we give that yes vote, I think that'll be the worst thing that this country's ever done, confirming. So,
can I switch you back to medieval times for a moment?
Yes, of course.
Well, you know, people thought the euro would be a great idea because they think exchange rates are expensive. You know, whenever you change a currency, you have to pay somebody for it. They thought, well, if we have a universal currency like America, like the United States, then everything will be all right. They did not realise that that's all very well, but if you're going to have 17 chancellors, then it's going to be a bit of a mess. But back in medieval times, they did have a European Union of currency then. It was called the mark. In English money, it was worth 13 and fourpence. And it wasn't a printed note or a coin. It was just accepted as being a unit that you could trade with. But even then, in medieval times, they were sensible enough to know that a Burgundy mark or a French mark or an English mark were not quite the same value. And so a consideration was made. They understood that 530 years ago.
Yes.
We don't even understand it today. So I thought I'd drag you back there, which is why I love this comparison.
Yes.
People had more space, incidentally, in those days. You know, the United Kingdom at the moment, we've got about 60 million people in 60 million acres. So everybody's got an acre. But, you know, the average medieval peasant would have about an acre to 20 acres himself, and quite a lot of buildings on it. It was certainly not the downtrodden people that some people like to think of nowadays.
So
they were well above the subsistence level as well.
So, Charles, if I could wave a magic wand, would you like to live in those times as against these times?
In some ways, I think it was the parasites which would put me off. You know, most people carried a lot of parasites, and one would get have difficulty in coming to terms with that. Let's be realistic.
Well, and my final question, Charles, of course, is, I guess we know the answer to this, but if there was a vote tomorrow on the referendum of stay or leave, where would your cross go?
Well, of course, it would be get out. I would be very sorry that our own Prime Minister would not be leading that. He could, if he had the qualities of leadership which we're looking for, he...
Can I just say, can pigs fly?
He should be the one to take us out. As it is, he was nearly the one who lost to Scotland.
Yes.
He's not up to the mark. He's not suitable. Incidentally, I actually remember quite well, and I'm just for the record, the referendum of 1975.
So do I.
When I was 30. And whatever anyone tells you about that, what we were voting for was a free trade area.
Yes.
And the economy, the British economy, was not in a good state then. You know, things like problems over Rhodesian copper actually rocked our economy. It wouldn't make any difference now. Our economy was much more fragile in those days. And people were told, if you want to come out, it'll cost us a lot of money, but if you stay in, you'll get cheaper wine. Well, it was a no-brainer, but that's the message.
So tell me, did you vote yes then?
I wanted to get out even then.
Did you vote no then?
Yes.
So did I. I voted no. And on that note, I'm going to say thank you, Charles, for today. It's been a great interview, and enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you, Vanessa.
Thank you. Bye then.
Bye.